Avi, you recently wrote an article about human leadership in crisis. I might be reading something into it, but the term human in the title, is there an indication there that some leaders forget about the human element?
Yeah, I think absolutely. I mean, the use of that that term in the title was very intentional. I think it's been fascinating, actually, for me going through this crisis period, both, you know, the lockdown period, the COVID crisis, and then now the economic impacts of that. Just exploring how important it is to be a good human. You know, I think we've talked as a country a lot about kindness and so on, but I think often leaders, when they're approaching managing a crisis like this, revert to very kind of operational and commercial aspects of what they need to do. Without kind of remembering that they're actually dealing with a team of humans. And through this crisis in particular, which I think is different to an economic crisis, there was a whole lot of fear and anxiety that was raised quite quickly that teams were trying to manage whilst also managing their workload. So I think all of your human qualities needed to be on their best display through this period. So yes, very intentional use of that term, human.
And you also, in your intro, you mentioned the word unprecedented, which has got to be one of the words of 2020. But it really was such a profoundly different time to other crises that we've been through, because everyone was in the same boat, and you do have that health element, but then you've got this kind of creeping economic element as well. So yeah. It's like a double whammy.
Yeah, and look, I'm sorry about the use of the word unprecedented, because I think, and I did use it in that article I wrote, but I must say that was fairly early stages of the crisis. But I think it absolutely was, and there's probably not a more appropriate term, actually, for what we were dealing with. And I think the very kind of scale of this crisis, and the fact that you had the kind of multifaceted elements of it being a health crisis, an economic crisis for businesses, it became a real operational crisis as they looked to mobilise technology that they hadn't had before. So there were so many components to it. And I don't think we've ever seen a kind of crisis or an event on such a global scale, where almost every business, every individual around the world was impacted by it. But it also wasn't evenly distributed, right? I mean, there were some sectors from a business perspective that were hit much harder than others through no fault of their own. And, you know, if I look back on how we, you know, and our businesses managed through this, all of our business continuity planning, for which we have kind of really detailed business continuity plans, none of them really foresaw something of this nature. You know, we might have had a kind of small health incident that we thought we'd be managed in a local market, you know, that might have impact for us for a few weeks or a month or something, and nothing that would be as enduring as this is turning out to be. And I think, you know, really we're only just getting started in terms of the true impact of it as well, right? I mean, in New Zealand, you know, we've done a remarkable job in terms of managing the health aspects of it, but we've done that at great cost, and you've seen already the impact of us having the borders closed. The second you open them up to anyone internationally, you risk bringing COVID into the country. And so, you know, we simply can't do that in a rush, which is meaning that the economic impacts are going to be really long and sustained. And I think we're also in a little bit of a false sense of security at the moment too, right? We've had these wage subsidies propping up businesses. I think as we've moved to level one, people have got their confidence back a little bit, but I think that'll be a short-term blip. Yeah. And then again, the realities of that will set in over the coming months, and we're going to be dealing with this for quite some time.
Yeah. Well, that's a lovely note. Yeah.
but within all of that as well, and we can talk about this, there's great kind of opportunity for disruption and business evolution, and societal evolution as well, actually. So it's not all bad news.
Yeah. So if we go back a little bit into the suddenness of it all, a lot of businesses, they were just like revenue had fallen off a cliff straight away, and then it was a bit of a scramble to figure out what to do. Another overused word, pivot, by the way. So there's a lot of that happening. Yeah. From your perspective, because often marketing and advertising, it seems so like as soon as there's a crisis, it seems to be one of the first things to for people to pull a lever on. How was it for you, being a sector that's across so many other sectors as well?
Yeah, I mean, we. I think we were fortunate in that we'd done a lot of planning over the last 12 months in terms of how we would respond in a situation where we had to rapidly implement new technology and so on. So just in terms of our business operations, we very much took a leadership approach and went early and sent everyone to work from home a good couple of weeks in advance of the government officially locking people down. So in that respect, it meant that our team was fully set up and ready to respond to client needs from day one. And actually what we saw within our clients was a lot of them scrambling to kind of catch up as they hadn't necessarily tested those systems and ways of communicating and so on. So in that respect, you know, we were kind of ready to go. So that moment, that particular moment, didn't necessarily hit us as hard. What did hit us hard, though, was just the client response to their marketing activity. And again, not kind of evenly distributed. So we had some sectors, like the clients that we have in the travel and tourism space, who almost ceased activity immediately, right, for obvious reasons. We had clients in the banking sector who weren't necessarily as immediately reactive. And then we had some retail clients who needed to rapidly move into new ways of operating. Mm-hmm. So I think, I mean, we're really fortunate in the way in which our group here is in New Zealand is constructed, and that we have a broad suite of capabilities from marketing and advertising, media capability, performance digital, but right through to customer strategy, digital transformation, and kind of customer communication. So that aspect of our business was actually really busy. Mm. But marketing components definitely did kind of pull back quite quickly. And what you were dealing with and what we found most challenging was just the kind of rapidly evolving situation. So, you know, we'd be looking at revenue one day, was very different the next day, and then it had changed again the day following, both ups and downs. So it was very hard for us to forecast in terms of what our business was going to look like for the coming months. Mm. And I know that was certainly an issue that a lot of businesses really struggled with, was the uncertainty more than the actual revenue decline. So I think if you have certainty around revenue decline and you know what you're planning to for, let's say, the next 6 or 12 months, you can manage your business around that. It's when you've got a situation that's kind of moving by the day or hour in some cases, and to really significant degrees, it's almost impossible for you to plan cost and resource management and so on around that. So that was probably the thing that we were grappling with the most.
Just from a business model perspective, that could potentially be applied to a whole lot of areas. Do you think that there is a lesson in having that kind of broad suite of capability, the multiple revenue streams?
Yeah, I mean, we would have been really exposed, I think, if we were all in as a media organisation, for example. And look, your sector is a prime example of that, right? And I think what you've done with M2 is great, because you've diversified into this type of content, digital revenue streams, as well as the print publication. But there are, you know, there are organisations within your sector who were hit really hard by the ability or the inability for them to be able to print, for example. You know, take Bauer as an example of that. So for us, I think if we were all in one, either one sector, one area of capability, I think that would have made life really difficult for us. But the ability for us to, I'll use the word pivot, for us to kind of refocus our energy into areas where clients needed that service the most was really helpful for us. And it just enabled us to kind of smooth out some of the edges that we had in terms of our revenue movement. So some parts of the business were hit really hard, but because we had other parts of the business performing quite strongly, it didn't have the holistic impact on our business that it could have otherwise. So yeah, so diversification, I would suggest, is really important for businesses looking forward.
There was a bit of a tone kind of thing at the time as well. You know, a lot of people were saying during the lockdown, and you know, we're still kind of dealing with minefield around how you market and how you promote yourself and how you sell. A lot of people were saying now's not the right time to sell, but it's so fundamental to an economy, right? To keep you got to keep passing things around and moving things around. What was your guidance over that period?
That's right, and that's actually not the feedback that we had from consumers over that period. So we very quickly realized that we needed to have a better understanding of how consumers or, you know, humans were responding through this situation in order for us to guide our clients. So almost 2 weeks into the lockdown, we implemented a quantitative research study interviewing New Zealanders on a weekly basis around how they were responding through the situation, how their interaction with media was changing, how they were viewing brand communications. So we were running that on a weekly basis as a tracker. And actually what we were seeing through that was anywhere from kind of 50 to 60% of people expecting brands to communicate as if they were operating business as usual. And I think we quite quickly saw a move from, you know, brands really kind of activating activity around COVID messaging. We care for you, all of that really kind of generic care washing. Brands were kind of instantly implementing that type of activity. But what consumers were telling us was they just wanted brands to continue as usual. You know, they were hearing enough about that stuff on the news. You know, they weren't expecting that brands would be able to solve all of the problems that came along with this crisis, and they just wanted them to give them some kind of more sense of normality. So I think as brands have activated through that period, and importantly now, what we've been advising our clients is to really ensure that you're providing some form of utility, something useful and practical that your customers can take from your business. Because as I said, this whole kind of care washing, virtue signaling, it's just kind of blanket across the comms industry at the moment. Yeah. And consumers see through that stuff really quickly.
Yeah, I had never really thought about that. That leads us to another. We should just make this a list of the overused words of 2020. But that kind of search for normality again. I never really thought about that. But you know, maybe that's behind the toilet paper psychology. That kind of thing. People just want that comfort. So yeah, maybe it was more a reaction against the care washing, as you say, and people just want to get back to kind of normal communication.
I think if you're a brand that was providing practical and useful products, services, and communication, then that stuff went down reasonably well. I think if you were a brand that was just talking about the fact that you were there to support customers without really doing anything to demonstrate that, then that was where brands found themselves in a relatively difficult situation, I think, where consumers were expecting much more from them, and just saying they were doing something simply wasn't enough. They're better off saying nothing at all, really.
In terms of another kind of tonal thing, do you think that this there seems to be a lot of traction behind the support local, the New Zealand made? Are you seeing that from your perspective? Is that sort of changing elements of the communication as well?
Yeah, I mean, we saw, and this was really interesting through the research, prior to going into the whole COVID situation, there was obviously a lot of discussion around sustainability and, removal of single-use plastics and so on. So very much a kind of macro interest and care for the environment and so on. What we saw happen quite quickly as we entered into the COVID situation was a real kind of narrowing of focus from consumers, right? So from saving the world to saving their community, their jobs, their family. And with that came a real desire to support their local community. So rather than them thinking about how they might, save someone in some far-flung part of the world, they're very much focused on their local cafe, their local bakery, and the local community that surrounds them. So that was a very real trend that we saw, and I think that will continue over the coming, 6-12 months. I think post that, again, as we settle into some form of normality, people are again going to be looking for the lowest cost, highest quality product at the lowest cost, essentially. So, whether that's a sustained trend or not, I'm not sure, but there's certainly a lot of really positive sentiment around the support local movement at the moment, which is great.
Yeah, I mean, we're a local magazine, so I'll milk that concept. That's great. But even when some people were slamming, say, takeaway, the large takeaway franchises, but they still employ local people. They still have local supply chains. So it's a little bit more, it's quite nuanced and complicated than, support local, bugger overseas people.
That's right. And a lot of that was just news media and messaging, right? So yes, there was that sentiment, but you only needed to look at the queues down the street to go into KFC or McDonald's when we first, kind of reopened those outlets. to demonstrate that consumer behaviour doesn't necessarily match what they say. So yes, there is a desire and a care to support your local community, but at the same time, you're going to seek out the products and services that you've always had a connection with. And, you know, as see, kind of KFC and McDonald's are prime examples of that. So yeah, it will be interesting to see how that plays out, you know, over time, I think.
And from if we look at you personally, so during lockdown, you've got to deal with a whole lot of uncertainty around the business side of things. You've got to be a good human leader to the organization and deal with people that are dealing with their own uncertainty. How was it for you personally dealing with, you know, the uncertainty, your family, and then trying to balance everything else?
Yeah, I mean, it feels really strange saying this, but it was a moment in time that I wouldn't say I enjoyed it, because we were dealing with, you know, massive implications in terms of how we managed our team through that crisis. But, you know, what I did really enjoy was the learnings and the challenge that came with how we managed the business through that period. And I think because there was so much to do in such a short space of time, and we were dealing with circumstances that we'd never experienced before, they're actually, you know, from a personal perspective, I didn't find there was a huge amount of time to stop and think. I mean, I was working from home. I've got two young daughters and a wife who also works full-time working from home. And I probably spent the entire day locked away in the bedroom working, you know, arguably busier than ever on stuff that I'd never been working on historically, just trying to keep the business moving, making sure that we had the right support in place for our people. So for me, I kind of really thrived on the challenge of that. But my primary focus was ensuring that we looked after the interests of our team. So we're nearly 300 people in the team across those various businesses. And I was most concerned about how we protect their jobs and their health, actually, you know, through that period. So I think because I had that as my focus, I didn't really think too much about the personal consequences, to be honest.
That's still a lot of weight, though, on your shoulders. I mean, how do you, when you're worrying about 300 people and their jobs and that kind of thing, how do you handle the pressure of that?
It's a good question. I mean, we actually talk about a lot in the business, the importance of people looking after their mental health. And I spoke a lot about that through the lockdown period and the need for people to take time out and so on. Didn't necessarily apply that to myself. It is a lot of way. I mean, I guess the way I managed that was just kind of chunking it down into the things that I could see in the immediate future, right? And you know, we talked quite a lot about controlling the things we could control. I think for whatever reason, I was able to kind of mentally break up the task and focus on those things that we needed to focus on immediately without getting too caught up in the weight of what might come further down the track and the implications of that. Mm-hmm. And we made some pretty swift decisions. I made the call really early that we would, certainly in the short term and through the COVID lockdown, we'd protect jobs. So we didn't implement any redundancies through that period. You know, we made some quick decisions around temporary cost measures, so salary reductions and so on. And I made the call that I kind of promised to the team that we'd overly communicate. We'd be really honest and authentic with how we did that. We'd give them the true picture of what was going on in the business. And I guess, you know, maybe looking back, because I was sharing with that degree of transparency and we were having those open conversations quite regularly, I almost felt like it wasn't just me in the situation managing. We were kind of all in it together. Maybe that helped. But I actually, you know, I actually felt like going through that period, it didn't feel like a weight.
Is there a point where you can become too authentic? Like if you don't have a clear picture of how viable things might be, say, 3 months down the track, is that the sort of stuff you'd share with the team? Or do you
to an extent. I mean, I'd share with the team what I knew today. Right. So, if I didn't have a clear and viable picture around what 3 months down the track looked like, then we'd have that conversation, you know, and we were dealing with a situation that was evolving quite quickly. I was giving the team regular updates around how our revenue was moving, not with, you know, a huge amount of detail because it wasn't necessary. But we were giving a lot of visibility around what was happening commercially to the business as a result of what was going on. And we needed to, right? If you're asking people to take sacrifices around their pay, which is all permission-based, obviously, you know, we're asking them to kind of clear out some of their annual leave balances and so on. I don't think it's fair to ask people to do that without giving them transparency around why they're doing that. So, I would really encourage as much as you possibly can as a leader, real authenticity in your communication, real transparency around the state of the business. And I don't think through that period you could over communicate. I mean, I was running sessions with the team where I'd give them a presentation on, you know, our immediate strategic priorities. I'd then do a follow-up Q&A the day after, recognizing that people didn't want to ask questions in an open forum, so they could submit them anonymously prior, and then I'd answer them with, again, with as much transparency as I could. And I think, you know, the feedback that we had through that period was that the communication really helped people understand, you know, what they needed to do and how the business was responding to the situation.
Has there been a silver lining that's come out of this in terms of maybe the unity of the team? Like, I know it's not ideal to have to be talking about pay cuts and that kind of thing, but is there, in terms of, you know, cutting out all the buffers of communication and just being totally open and transparent and working on it as a team, is that, do you think that's kind of created a tighter team?
Yeah, I think really, I don't think it's sustainable in its current form in terms of virtual communication, because I think you really need that physical contact and the hallway conversations and so on to build that collaboration. But I think in terms of unity, everyone did feel like they were in it together, you know, and we were having really regular all-staff communications that we probably don't do as regularly when we're all together in person, just as harder logistically to organise people. And then the teams within the business were all doing that within their smaller groups as well. So I think communication was probably better than it's ever been. And it also, and I think most businesses will say this, it really accelerated our use of technology to collaborate and interact with each other as well. So we use Microsoft Teams. We'd had that in place for 12 to 18 months prior. No one was really using it. Now everyone's on Teams. You know, we're doing collaborative documents based on Teams. So the kind of way of working has changed quite quickly. And I think with that comes a sense of unity as well. But what we're also seeing is people kind of, you know, keen to get back into the office, to be collaborating in person. And I think, again, you know, coming back to the human elements of that, that's really important.
We spoke to Greg Cross, the co-founder of Soul Machines, last week, and he's been fairly vocal talking about how far behind a lot of our businesses have been in terms of our digital resiliency. And it's all very well for us to blame government for not getting behind SMEs, but we have an environment where we've got ultra fast broadband connected everywhere. Like, we should be a lot further ahead than we are. Have you seen that from your perspective? Have a lot of the people that you deal with, have they had a bit of work to do in terms of playing digital catch up?
Yeah, I think in two respects. So one, operationally, so just how they run their business. So I think there's been a lot of that. And, you know, some of these clients are big corporate organisations that haven't necessarily had the systems and processes in place to work in a fully remote manner. So I think for the first couple of weeks in particular, that really caught a number of them by surprise. I think very quickly, though, those organisations were able to kind of catch up and implement those systems and be working pretty effectively. So there's kind of the operational aspects of that and just running the business. And then there's the customer-facing aspects of that as well, right? So how you manage your customer communications, the kind of customer centricity and CX within your business, the e-commerce capability. And again, you know, if I look at, not so much within our client base, but if I look at the market and some of the big retailers that were caught out by not having adequate e-commerce solutions in place, was really surprising. So again, I think it's forced a lot of those organizations to rethink how they kind of structure their digital economy capability going forward. And, you know, you've already heard of a number of retailers who have kind of closed, you know, physical outlets in favor of building more robust distribution centres for e-commerce and so on. So I think, yeah, there were two aspects to that, really, the operational aspects and then the more customer-facing components. And there's a, you know, kind of very well-worn kind of anecdote or quote around the question, what drove digital transformation fastest within your business, right? Was it your CTO, your CIO, or COVID-19? And I think it really did, force organizations to think quite rapidly, in terms of how their digital capability works within their organization.
So do you get the sense that, this has forced businesses to be a lot stronger, a lot more efficient, a lot more, are we going to see that? Has it been a bit of a flush out?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think what you'll see is a lot of businesses really doubling down on focus on the key talent, the key capabilities that they have. I think anything that was margin dilutive or periphery to their business will probably be cut, and a much more singular focus for those businesses around their strategic priorities. Mm. We talked about diversification earlier, so I think diversification is important, but I think businesses will trim first before they then look to add, diversified or adjacent services. In terms of the total business ecosystem, as difficult as this is, it will trim out a lot of the fat that might exist in some of our sectors, where there are competitors that were a little bit weaker. Those will disappear, and I think you'll see new players, new startups with new models emerge as a result, which will be interesting, right? Because there's great opportunity to be had within this environment. What consumers are looking for is disruptors who have new ways of doing things, who are much more digitally focused and customer centric in how they go to market. And so I think we'll see a real emergence of those types of businesses.
If this is a really unfair question, but can you give us any green shoots within that? I mean, do you suspect that there will be areas which will be rife with the sort of disruption that you're talking about? Are you imagining any new sectors emerging or even?
It's a tough question off the cuff. I think I don't know that there'll be any sector that's immune to this. But I think what will be interesting is how quickly some of those new competitors emerge. And what is going to happen is there is a lot of people who are in larger organizations who have either been made redundant or who have viewed this as an opportunity to rethink their future. And a number of those will be looking at startup opportunities simply because the job pools aren't there. And you can kind of see this in your sector with, a number of individuals coming out of some media organizations, setting up new entities. I can see it already in our sector where you've got people who have come out of agencies and are setting up new consultancies. So where all of that lands, I don't know, but I think in most sectors you'll see new competitors emerge. The restaurant kind of hospitality industry has been fascinating through this, right? We've had a lot of restaurants kind of move into much more food delivery, digital commerce, similar to a My Food Bag type proposition. And whether those are sustained in the future, if you come through that and you realize that there's more profit in that, would you, continue to run a restaurant, with all logistics that goes with that? I'm not sure. So I think it'll be interesting, but I don't think there's any sector that's not ripe for disruption. I can't give you off the top of my head though, who that might be.
No, that's cool. That was a good answer. I'll take that. In terms of this new future with all these entrepreneurs running around, are there certain skills that we need to be encouraging in our children to be able to help them create a stronger New Zealand future as well? And maybe it doesn't necessarily need to be defined skills as in coding, but even a sort of an attitude, an ability to deal with uncertainty, perhaps. Is there something there that we should be training our kids for?
Yeah, I think it's exactly that. One thing we've talked a lot about, again, in our business, which I think is really important for my children as well, and I know the schools are talking about this, is resilience and the ability to come through kind of unusual and challenging situations like this and with strength and with optimism and to kind of view the opportunities within that. So I think that, resilience is one. I think adaptability. And again, we kind of see that within how our business is responding with real agility. We're looking at our clients and encouraging them to, really operate with agility. So the ability for someone, a young person or a leader within a business to be able to move with real agility, I think is important. All the digital skills that you've talked about, so, you know, not necessarily coding, but everything that comes with that. Obviously, that's only going to be more important as we move into the future. I think, you know, again, we've talked about this, but really encouraging the kind of human connection, you know, and it's something that can get a little bit lost when you're constantly on video calls. But just connecting with people in really authentic and human ways, caring for each other, you know, and those aren't necessarily terms that we use enough, I don't think, in business, you know, because we do view often things through the filter of a P&L and, you know, the commercial aspects of a business. So those qualities, you know, kind of care and so on are really important, I think, for our young people. Diversity of thinking. And you know, I think that's been really important through our business, again, because we've had, you know, multi-dimensional capabilities we've been able to bring to bear. It has really encouraged at a rapid pace, much greater kind of diversity of thinking to solve business problems for our clients. So really being able to collaborate and work with a diverse set of individuals to solve problems in unique and differentiated ways, because it's been a unique situation, you know, those qualities have been really important as well. Yeah, off the top of my head.
Wow, there's a lot there. There's probably a couple of things. I'm really interested in the diversity of thinking, though, when it comes to solving business problems. Can you give an example? I wonder if there's so much potential in even in other cultures. Like if you look at Indigenous thinking around timeframes, is that what you're talking about in terms of looking at, you know, different considerations when you're looking at the motivation of the business or the planning of a business? Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, I mean, we talk about diversity of thinking actually consisting of a number of different components. So ethnic diversity, which is you know, what we're suggesting there, and taking influence from other cultures in terms of how they operate. And, you know, I'll be the first to say that we're not doing enough in respect to that. We, you know, we're very kind of passionately committed to doing more, but we haven't done enough. And our industry is massively underrepresented in some of those ethnicities, you know, Māori and Pacific Island in particular. So that's kind of one component of it. Diversity of thinking in terms of kind of cultural backgrounds. But by that I don't mean ethnicity, but you know, kind of where you grew up and the environment you grew up in, you know, whether you grew up on a farm or whether you grew up in a city, you know, so there's that. Diversity of thinking in terms of gender, sexuality, and then capability. You know, do you come to solving a problem from a creative perspective? Do you come from a technical perspective, a coding background, as you suggest, from a management or a people focus? And we work really hard on trying to bring together, under what we call our open teaming approach, very different thinkers to solve business problems for our clients. And again, that's the benefit we have as being a multi-dimensional business, and that we really can take someone who is a technology consultant, you know, maybe working on the Salesforce platform. We can get them together with a creative individual who might be a writer. We can put them with someone who is really focused on how we build our customer experience for our clients, with a media person. And it's that kind of breadth of thinking that really does step change the types of solutions you can solve for clients. Because I think if you come at it from a very one-dimensional perspective, you're going to get a one-dimensional answer. So we really try and encourage all of those aspects of diversity. And I think that's only going to become more important as the problems we're trying to solve for businesses and society become more complex.
I've been slowly working on the side lobbying for more Bogan representation at boarding cabinet level. But it's a work in progress.
We have that many Bogans in our business.
There you go. Some more work to do.
Underrepresented in Bogans.
Absolutely. Now, you mentioned before, I know, you know, we have to, it's good to be optimistic, but we do have the reality of the fact that, you know, the helicopter money is going to run out soon and there will be flow on effect. But how do you think we can capitalize on our position globally? You know, we are seen as a relative safe haven. You've got the potential investment of the likes of Microsoft and that kind of thing. Are there things that we could be doing to really capitalize on this?
Yeah, and I think we also have a kind of history of being a bit of a pioneer in innovative culture, right? And we might have lost our way on this, I think, in the past few years, potentially, but there's great opportunity for us at the bottom of the world in a small market to test new ways of working, new ways of doing things, and kind of new products and services. So I think there's real potential for innovation to come out of this. And, you know, if I look at global organizations, and we're one of those, you know, we've got a number of clients that are global organizations, there's the potential for them to look at us as a test market for things, you know, that is now, we're now ahead, obviously, in terms of the world, in terms of how we've responded to the COVID situation, but use us as a test case for programs of activity that they can then potentially roll out globally. So I think there's real opportunity for that. And, you know, we're a sophisticated market with relatively small scale. We've got great talent in this country. So the opportunity for us to really harness that to build a new digital economy future in a way that's differentiated internationally, whilst the rest of the world is still, quite frankly, struggling to manage the health crisis. Mm. You know, I think that's a really interesting opportunity for us. But you've got to have a real appetite for that. And, you know, I think we still have a number of pockets of our society and of our business community who are still pretty traditional. And those are the businesses that will struggle, I think, through this, where there are other businesses who are really looking and hunting for opportunity and are optimistic about the growth potential. There are those that will be very protectionist around their current position and their current way of working. And I think those are the businesses that will struggle. So we're going to end up, I think, in a bit of a two-speed economy.
It's interesting. We'll have a link to your 10 principles, but is there one particular principle that you're most fond of?
I think just coming back to that kind of need to be a good human and all the aspects that come with that, right? So, you know, being authentic, being compassionate, showing gratitude, having real care for people. I think all of those are just, you know, qualities of being a good human. And I think if you apply that and you think about how you treat your team through a very human lens, then I think that the team will respond really well to that. It doesn't mean you can't take tough commercial decisions. But I think it's the way in which you deliver those and the way in which you implement those that people judge you on, not the decisions themselves, because people understand that we're dealing in a pretty tough commercial reality.
Yeah. That is the reality of it. As a leader, you do have to make tough decisions, but you can at least afford people the dignity and respect along the way.
Yeah, that's right. And thank them. You know, I talk about gratitude in there. I think, you know, we should be immensely grateful for the way all of our teams within all of our businesses have responded through this, because not only have they had to kind of keep the lights on of businesses in some respects, but, you know, they've been managing the demands of family at home, you know, in a lot of cases, reduced pay, reduced hours, the impact that has on their personal situation. They've had real anxiety around their kind of health situation and their financial security and so on. So be grateful for the work that people are doing for you.
Mm. There's no segue from this, but have you been binging anything on Netflix or streaming services over the last wee while?
Well, there's a real lack of anything quality to watch, I think, at the moment, because I'd watched a whole lot of stuff prior to COVID, and then because of the production community's dried up completely, there's nothing new coming through. So I'm a massive fan of Billions. I've really enjoyed Billions on Neon, and actually just watched the last episode, which is a mid-season episode because they had to cease production because of COVID, and it's the first fictionalized TV show I've watched that's had reference to the early stages of coronavirus in it in the last episode. And then because I'd run out of other things to watch, I started watching Money Heist.
Oh, cool.
Which I quite enjoyed. I'd really encourage you to watch that with subtitles, not with the overdub. I watched about the first 5 minutes with overdub and it's terrible. So yeah, watch it with subtitles.
Brilliant. One last question, a question about questions, but have you got one question that you'd like me to include in my next interview to another leader, another human?
It's a really tough one on the spot. Well, it depends on who you're talking to, right? But I'd be really interested to know what kind of view they have of what New Zealand will look like in 12 months' time. You know, none of us can predict the future, right? We don't know where this health crisis and how that will evolve, or the recessionary crisis that is about to follow, will take us. But it will be really interesting to see, I think, how New Zealand has responded to that within 12 months' time.
I was just throwing a sneaky add-on question, but are you optimistic?
Super. Yeah. I mean, I've remained optimistic throughout this. I think, you know, despite all the challenges we're facing, there's real opportunity for the future. I think, you know, it gave us a great opportunity from day one to review all our strategies for the business, to reset those. And I think it's created a whole lot of new strategic priorities for us that we hadn't seen before. So I'm really excited about the future. I think there's great opportunity for our sector. I think there's great opportunity for New Zealand and for businesses. But it's not going to be easy. Like, we've got a really tough road ahead of us, I think.